This morning, the Royal College of Nursing have reported on the Nolan Show that they believe the draft guidelines on abortion as issued by the Department of Health are not fit for purpose, is what they have said. Now, Dr. Peter Saunders is CEO of the Christian Medical Fellowship. Good morning to you, Dr. Saunders.
Good morning.
Good morning. We've been talking expansively and extensively about this here, and it is a divisive issue. It's one that, many people have strong opinions on both sides. What are your views on the abortion guidelines, the abortion law in Northern Ireland?
Well, I think with regard to guidelines, guidelines cannot change the law. They must accurately reflect the law, and they should be clear about that so that people know where they stand. But they can't go into great detail about every case. They lay down broad principles. With regard to the law, it's only Parliament in Northern Ireland that can change that, and laws on issues like this shouldn't be changed unless, you know, until there's been really very considerable consultation and thought into the consequences of doing that. I listened to the interview you were having before with the person from the Royal College of Nursing, and I was sort of left feeling that you were discussing something that wasn't really the issue there, because in the UK here, we have had, or in Britain, we've had abortion legal since 1967. We have 200,000 abortions a year, 7 million since the Abortion Act came in. The law is actually quite tight, and yet abortions are done for each and every reason. People, it's accepted that people generally flout the law. And yet I can't think of any nurse or doctor who's been punished or jailed or imprisoned for not participating, or anyone who's actually gone to prison for promoting or assisting.
And yet,
in fact, even in Northern Ireland, because they keep the statistics here very accurately, and I can tell you that in 2012, there were 905 women who came from Northern Ireland to have abortions in England and Wales alone. I mean, there may have been others in Scotland, and I don't know of a single case where there was a court case or an arrest or a prosecution or whatever.
But you have you still have, Dr. Saunders, you still have the Department of Health issuing draft guidelines. If these guidelines were to be accepted, they are very clearly stating that there is a significant chance. They don't use the word significant, but if it's in these guidelines, it is significant. There is at least a chance. They describe it as a grey area in which someone could go to jail for advocating or promoting abortion. Now, what does promoting abortion mean? Does that mean saying, well, you might want to consider it? Is that what a health professional is going to go to jail for?
The job,
we don't know.
No, the job of the Department of Health is to accurately reflect the law as it's stated in Northern Ireland. And the law in Northern Ireland allows abortion only in very, very restricted circumstances. We know that's what the law actually says. You can only have an abortion in Northern Ireland if it's necessary to preserve the life of the woman, or there's a risk of real and serious adverse effects on her physical or mental health, which is either long-term or permanent. That is the law. So any guideline has to reflect that. And the way these cases work, the way any law works, is that if there's an alleged breach of it, then evidence is presented and the Crown Prosecution Service, the Director of Public Prosecutions, has to make a decision, firstly, whether there's enough evidence to bring a prosecution, and secondly, whether it's in the public interest to do so.
Except, that's all fair comment. That's absolutely fair, Dr. Saunders. Except, if we take the example of assisted suicide across the water in Britain, and the public debate and the public unease and the public, I guess, uncertainty, the lack of clarification that there was around whether a relative who assisted someone in taking their own life would be prosecuted. What happened there was the director of the Crown Prosecution Service, a man called Keir Starmer, he made a public statement in order to give further clarity to the general public, which is why I'm asking the question, where is the Public Prosecution Service in Northern Ireland providing clarity around this? Where are they?
Where do you think there should be clarity, Stephen? But I mean, what particular clarity?
I'm asking if there should be clarity around draft guidelines, which the Department of Health themselves describe as a grey area.
Well, it's any area in law is grey because in any statute of law they lay down the general principles, and then if cases come to court, the courts make a judgment, and those help to further refine and define the law. So that's the case with every law that we have on the statute.
Let me put it a different way, Peter. This is really, really important stuff. I'll tell you why it's important. It's important for obvious reasons. It's also important because I'm some of these families who are in this situation, they're saying to me they don't know. Now that's how I know this is a real issue. People, not hypothetically in this situation, people who are in this situation now. I can quote one family to you. The father is called Chris. The mother is called Laura. They intend to go to England within the next week for an abortion. And Chris doesn't know whether he's going to go to jail if he goes with Laura. He doesn't know if he's going to go to jail if he helps buy the plane ticket. If he assists her going to an abortion clinic, is that advocating or promoting to a pregnant woman an abortion? Is it not for the director of the Public Prosecution Service in Northern Ireland to provide some clarity as to whether they would seek a prosecution around that? Is it unreasonable for me to ask that question?
The law is very clear in Northern Ireland. I've just read it out for you. I think everybody who's interested in this debate knows what it actually says, and clearly there is obviously some theoretical risk, but what I'm telling you is that with 7 million abortions in Britain, I'm not aware of anyone who's been prosecuted, and of the 905 Northern Irish who went last year, there isn't. Right. And that's why I think this is not really the issue.
I will move on to that issue. Dr. Saunders, but then you see there's a really interesting question. If it's only a theoretical risk, if it's never happened before, here's a really important question. Why was it written into the guidelines? Why? And there's lots of speculation around that in itself. Why was it written into these guidelines?
We're speculating as to why, but I would, giving the people who drafted the guidelines the benefit of the doubt, I would say that they probably put it in the guidelines because they felt an obligation to reflect accurately the law, and that's why it's there. But as I say, I don't think this is the real issue. The real issue here is about these cases that you've been discussing.
And I've been reading, and that's what we should really be talking about. Let's do so now, because I was reading actually last night on your blog about the cases. You've been commenting about the cases that we've been dealing with on the Nolan Show, namely Sarah and her husband, Jason, who went to London last week and indeed had an abortion in London last week. And I thought that your comments were so interesting, not for me to say who should agree or shouldn't agree with them, but they were so interesting I thought that you should have a platform to expand on them today. And you're familiar with Sarah's case because you've written about it. She had an abortion last week for a baby. The baby had anencephaly, which essentially meant that the brain would not form properly, and indeed the brain would grow. There would not be a skull, and the baby would likely die either during pregnancy or just after the baby was born. Now, do you think Sarah should have had to have gone to London for an abortion, Dr. Saunders?
Well, my blog, which was titled 20 Reasons to Think Twice About Aborting a Baby with Anencephaly, was not making any sort of judgment or giving an opinion on Sarah's particular case. What I wanted to do was to raise questions in people's minds, because I felt that the way this case had been dealt with on the media didn't reflect the facts accurately about anencephaly and didn't really deal with what I see as the two really key questions. First, with regard to anencephaly, the condition, it's very serious. It's a form of spina bifida where the neural tube doesn't fuse properly. And as a result, part of the skull, the upper part of the skull, is missing. And the cerebral hemispheres, the thinking parts of our brain, are not there. But the brain stem still is, which means that the baby is not brain dead. It still breathes. It can breathe without a ventilator after birth. Many of them do die within pregnancy. but a substantial number are born. Some live a few hours, some a few days, some even a few years. In fact, I think the longest survivor is about 6 years, but that's incredibly unusual. The vast majority will die during pregnancy or within a few hours or days of birth. So a baby with anencephaly is certainly not brain dead. It's a baby with a severe disability. But I think the two questions I wanted to raise on this issue were, firstly, and I think they're absolutely fundamental before we sort of rush off and look at decisions about what should happen with the law, I think we have to think about these questions first. The first one is, what is a baby with anencephaly? And the second question, which is just as important, is how do you look after a woman who's just heard the most devastating news of her life, that her baby has a severe disability, is going to die during pregnancy or shortly afterwards, and is in the midst of absolute crisis? How do you deal with a woman like that? And it's those two questions that interest me most as a doctor, having, you know, known many people with these cases and seen the trauma of it. And I think the first question, what is a baby with anencephaly? And there are different views on that that have been expressed on your program. But I think the starting point is to say a baby with anencephaly is, first of all, a human being. A baby with anencephaly is not brain dead. A baby with anencephaly is a deeply dependent relative with a terminal illness who's going to die. A baby with anencephaly is a disabled person with special needs.
Yeah,
and I think that when we start with that, then it's only then that we've got to ask the question, how do you manage and treat a person with special needs?
Well, of course,
who's disabled, who's terminally ill.
Of course,
that's the first question.
Yeah, well, but you said when you start with that, Dr. Saunderson, you'll understand why I will push back in order for this to be balanced. It's a question of if you start with that, because that is your position, that is your opinion. It is the opinion of others, and indeed some of the parents involved, that they do not recognise the fetus as a baby, and they do not recognise that there is any significant brain function within the fetus that is inside that mother.
But if the baby didn't have a disability, they would be talking about my baby from very, very early in pregnancy, wouldn't they?
Well, how much brain function is there? Can the baby experience emotion?
I mean, there's a debate about how much emotion is a brain stem and cerebral function, but do you need to have a brain to be a human being? Do you need to have every part of your brain there? Do you need to have every part of your body there? I would say that regardless of what level of deformity we have, or sickness, or fragility, or intellectual impairment, or even what people think of us, we are human by virtue of being conceived by human beings.
But the babies are not conscious. You say this in your own blog. They do not experience consciousness.
But are you then suggesting that everybody who's unconscious can have their life ended?
Can I?
I mean, people with dementia are not conscious. Are you suggesting that we should end the lives of people with dementia because they're not conscious? So this is my question. What is a baby with anencephaly? That's the first thing.
Yeah, can I put that question?
What do you think, Stephen? Well, what do you think a baby with anencephaly is? Do you think it's a human being with a disability that has a terminal illness?
Well,
terminal condition? Is that how you see it?
Well,
that
is a matter for each and every individual to interpret in their own way. And another part of this debate, as you
but
know...
But how do you see it, personally? Well, I mean, I've told you what I think. What do you think?
Well, obviously, Dr.
Saunders... with anencephaly is.
Obviously, Dr. Saunders, you must be intelligent enough to understand the role of a BBC presenter in this. And I'm not going to state my personal opinion, but I am going to say that... You know, I'm going to ask the question back for you. Is it not the entitlement of the parent to decide for themselves how they interpret what is inside them?
Well, then I'd ask you the question, is it the right of any relative to decide about the status of any of their dependent relatives with a terminal condition? Yeah.
Can I ask you a question related to that? Because you talk about consciousness and what the implications are if you do or do not have brain activity. Let's speak hypothetically. If a car accident, Dr. Saunders, left a person with a similar level of brain activity, would it be possible or acceptable to switch off life support, which is what doctors and hospitals do?
Well, that's a very interesting question. You see, the point is that in an anencephaly, the brain stem is still functioning, so the baby can breathe without being on a ventilator. And in the same way, if you had a road accident and you were fully and completely brain dead, then it is accepted that it's admissible to turn off a ventilator because the patient is dead. But if you just have a severe brain injury and you're not brain dead and you're still able to breathe, then it wouldn't be deemed acceptable to actively end the life of that person. Yeah, you'd look after them, you'd give them nutrition, care, warmth,
but obviously,
human presence and all those sorts of things.
But obviously, Dr. Saunders, there are so many nuances in this, isn't there? Because in the situation in which you argue that it is acceptable to switch off a life support machine because that person is brain dead, but they are still breathing. You could.
No, but then they're not. Someone who's brain dead, you can push air in and out of their lungs with a ventilator. Mm-hmm. But babies with anencephaly are not brain dead. They breathe without ventilators. Some of them breathe for years. A lot of them breathe for several days.
And yet
they're not brain dead.
And yet there are situations in our hospitals throughout the United Kingdom in which people's organs are still working, in which they are experiencing a degree of human life, and life support is switched off.
Well, there are other conditions like, some examples of them, you mentioned trauma, severe stroke, brain tumours, dementia. These are all conditions which can so destroy the thinking part of the brain that people are, in effect, not aware, they're unconscious, but they still go on breathing. They're not brain dead. Now, what I'm saying is that in those circumstances, we don't think it's acceptable to end their lives and give them lethal injections. So why do we think it's acceptable in anencephaly? And that brings me on to the other question, which I think is incredibly important. As a doctor, having looked after people in deep crisis, is what's the best way of managing a woman and helping and supporting a woman who's just had the devastating news that her baby is going to die shortly after birth and she's in absolute crisis? What's the best way of managing her? Because there seems to be an assumption here that the only way of dealing with this, or the best way of dealing this, is to charge in immediately and offer her an abortion. And since I put my blog up, it's been quite amazing because I've had lots and lots of people coming to me, sharing their experiences. And these are all women with babies with severe disabilities and abnormalities, some of them with anencephaly, some of them with other conditions. And all of them have come along. They've all thanked me for raising those issues and told their incredibly moving stories about how they were supported through this incredible crisis and devastating news to be able to go on and treasure and really make the very best of the weeks that they had with their poor dying baby. And one thing that hasn't come out in your program is that, we know that some people suffer psychological and mental consequences from abortion. That's known. But the ones who are most vulnerable are those who have a deep emotional bond with the baby and who desperately wanted the baby and who have a baby that's well-developed late in pregnancy. Those are the ones who suffer the most grief and depression. And the problem is, if you have a baby with profound special needs and profound disability, then whatever decision you make, it's going to change your life forever. Your life's already been changed forever simply by virtue of having the baby. And I think women in this situation They need a huge amount of time and support and space. They need to be able to talk to other women who've been through the experience. And the last thing they need is to be sort of whisked off in a knee-jerk response, to have an abortion, because there is another way. And that's really what I'm wanting people to think about, that other way and how we can better support women
in
this situation.
Your language is slightly loaded this morning, Dr. Saunders, isn't it, in terms of this knee-jerk response. Certainly the families I have spoken to would reject that they made any type of knee-jerk response whatsoever. And also when you talk this morning, Dr. Saunders, about having met ladies, women, who have had a lot of comfort from not having had an abortion, have you met any women who indeed have had comfort from having had an abortion? And do you understand that?
I know that some women, particularly early in pregnancy, will go through an abortion and seem to have no great relief and no mental health consequences at all. But, you know, have you ever, I tell you, I've sat in a delivery ward and I have read through the remembrance book of couples who've lost their children through abortion for disability. And I tell you, there is a huge amount of pain and trauma and suffering and, you know, all the things they wanted to say to their baby but were unable to, that comes out in that. And what I'm concerned about is that abortion is being promoted as a sort of solution to the situation, when actually the best way, and the thing that, I mean, I used to think differently about this. What changed me as a junior doctor was that I had a colleague on the ward who had a baby with anencephaly. And, you know, I was surprised she didn't choose an abortion. I was just in my first year out after qualifying from medical school. And, you know, she said to me, this is absolutely devastating, but I just don't feel I can end the life of my baby. I want to love it and cherish the time
I've got. But at the heart of...
And she had this baby. It lived for 7 days. She nursed it. She cared for it. She said all the things she wanted to say for it, to it. And, you know, was a mother to this deeply disabled, dying relative.
But what...
And when I saw the way she came through that, I thought, you know, I didn't even think it was possible to do that, but it really challenged me. And I really changed my views as a result of that case.
But what this comes down to,
I've seen since.
What this comes down to is to whether the individual mother has an individual right to do what she thinks is right for her. That's what this comes down to.
I think that's one part of it, but I think what we have to remember here, and this is what I keep stressing, is that we have two very needy individuals here. We have a dying disabled baby with special needs, and we have a woman who's just heard the most devastating news of her life, isn't in the middle of crisis, who's deeply traumatized. And I think we have to think about what we can do, how we can do the best for each of those people. And it's on the basis of my experience, the people I've heard from, what I've observed with either decision is that the best way is to help that mother to cherish the moment she has with her dying baby and to come through that grief well supported, and give her the time and space to make an unpressured decision.
Well, look, Dr. Saunders, if people want to read your blog, it's called Christian Medical Comment. It's an interesting blog. There is an inaccuracy in it. When you say you were deeply shocked that the BBC would interview a deeply traumatised, grieving woman in front of a national audience within days of the most horrendous experience of her life, aborting her own baby, that is completely inaccurate. We interviewed her before her abortion, but it is an interesting blog, and I'm sure people will read it. And thank you so much.
Did you not interview her
for
after?
Your time. No, we did not.
Okay, well, I will change that.
No, we did not. Okay, Dr. Saunders, thank you very much indeed.